It's always pleasant to share times of worship with friends, and it's particularly pleasant to have Claudia with us this morning. We've known her for more years than any of us care to imagine or remember, but she grew up in Chicago, was educated in Ohio and California, and has worked in places as diverse as Yale and Harvard and in Texas, and now she's the Dean of Religious Life at Connecticut College. She's a good and dear friend. We count her as part of our family. She's preached for us before, and so those of you that have heard her know that she's a wonderful addition to our pulpit team. We're delighted that she's with us. Claudia.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
I have done a series of reflections this morning, speaking particularly with a focus on issues of justice. And I wrote my sermon well before the events of this week, but I feel compelled to ask you to remember and hold in your hearts the power and the life and the authority of Nelson Mandela as we move forward on this earth. He was an amazing man, and he brought to us a great deal of vision and certainly intention on the path preparing the way. So I feel kind of bad, Clint, because this is a political sermon, and it is about the fact that I do want us to be in favor of people who have an agenda. So see what you think as I move along here. Thinking and planning on this sermon, I made the decision to remember in particular, because this is what I do, the work of young people in the 60s, and commemorate a kind of theological reflection, a narrative of events that happened now 50 years ago. These events are in large part the substantive content for shaping my particular values, my identity, and my vocation. In addition, I'm not sure that it will be clear to everyone here on hearing my sermon that the church that I grew up in, the times and the church, the faith community that shaped me and named me and gave me hope, is the same distinct fellowship of Christian bodies that made up the civil rights movement. I'm sorry to say that that church no longer exists. My ministry is a combination of U.S. history, the black church as an agent of change, and the activism of people of faith who believed in truth. Truth and justice and love as they lived their lives and made their commitments and taught their young people to live and work in accordance with what I understand to be the gospel of Jesus Christ. I hope that you will be prayerful with me as we examine these memories and decide if the work of the faithful has the power or the feet to keep on moving forward. And so we begin. In my senior year in college, which was a long time ago, there was a new musical that was premiered. It was called Godspell. Has anybody heard of it? I was not a church-going girl in college. It was the end of the 60s, a violent and disruptive decade, and a very hard time for folks like me whose adolescence was formed by political and cultural violence and mayhem. The town where I attended college did not have a church that was attentive to the times. It was not a place that gave anyone inspiration, affirmation, or hope. I love to tell people that I turned 13 in the year that President Kennedy was killed and 20 in the year of the Kent State murders. I was confused, frustrated, mired in a deep quicksand of shifting mores and values. Racism, militarism, sexism, and more were starting to invade private boundaries and cause huge discomfort while wreaking havoc on the status quo things were very difficult. Godspell was a godsend. The operetta, originally a class project, if you can believe it, for a master student who attended Carnegie Mellon University, opened off-Broadway in Greenwich Village in 1971. It played to great acclaim for several years. The memorable thing for me about Godspell was it was an album that absolutely everybody on campus had in my senior year. It was the music that you heard playing out of dorm rooms all across campus. It was so very upbeat, easy to remember, lyrics and a storyline based on the parables and the New Testament Gospels of Matthew and Luke. Godspell was my adolescent spiritual revival, and the opening hymn was my favorite, Prepare Ye the Way of the Lord. I would love to sing it for you, but I was not raised in the Church of Christ, and if I sang, you would run screaming from the room. So my assignment is for you to go home and Google Godspell and listen to these hymns. They're beautiful. Looking back, I think that one of the real wondrous miracles of Godspell was the possibility that it brought to young adults like myself back to a listening and reflective place after a decade of horrid violence and confrontation. The changes in the 60s for life in the United States of America were things that were difficult to grasp or even begin to comprehend. The good old days were dead forever, and new Holy Spirits needed to take hold of the lives and hopes of a new generation, my generation. Godspell renewed me. I played the album every day in my senior year. I prayed the songs and believed and worked very hard on preparing the way of the Lord and living the words of my favorite tune day by day. Day by day, I prayed to see thee more clearly, to love thee more dearly, to follow thee more nearly day by day. The end of the 60s was the beginning of a new era, another difficult time, and the continuation of preparing and paving the way for the long, hard road ahead. This morning, I want to do a thing that preachers like to do. I want to tell a few stories, plant some seeds in your memory, and add some details to American history, and ask you to listen, reflect, and pray, and move gently, intentionally, and purposefully onto the road ahead, armed with the tools from our text, the same ones used by our predecessor, John the Baptist. I guess I'm asking all of us to sign on to prepare the way. This year, 2013, is the 50th anniversary of a lot of things that shaped the work of the Civil Rights Movement. The movement began in churches, led by Christian ministers and other religious leaders. Our history doesn't tell that. The movement was organized by women who were community activists. It was inspired by college students who taught in the freedom schools and staffed the voter registration drives and marched in the streets. The movement was moved by children and young adults who marched and sang and walked and demonstrated. Some sacrificed their lives so that those of us who are here today might experience a new way of being in a state of freedom. These people prepared the way. Medgar Evers was born on July 2, 1925. He was shot to death 50 years ago on June 12, 1963 by Brian De La Beckwith, who was a fertilizer salesman and a member of the White Citizens Council. Following two trials and two hung juries, Mr. De La Beckwith walked free for most of 30 years following the assassination of Mr. Evers until he was convicted of murder in February of 1994. In those days, juries in places like Jackson, Mississippi, where the murder occurred, were composed entirely of white males. There was no real concept that a white man could be guilty of murder in the case of a black man, particularly one who was a troublemaker. A troublemaker was defined as a person working for justice. In an earlier part of our country's history, best practices was injustice, and murder was the solution for those who thought otherwise. The death of Medgar Evers as an NAACP field secretary caused a great deal of anger and riotous rebellion in the Negro communities across the country. The murder and trial was the beginning of Negroes using their voices to ask questions about the court system, about voting, about what it means to have a father, husband, and gainfully employed black man gunned down at his own home with no one held responsible. Medgar Evers, from all I can tell, became an icon because he had come as close as possible to achieving what we call the American dream. He lived in a new home in a middle-class neighborhood with a lovely wife, three children, a World War II veteran with a college education. His legacy as an accomplished middle American thrives as a model for hard work and sacrifice, the price of which was martyrdom. For most Negroes in the early 60s America, death was just too much of a price to pay for success and leadership. On September 15th, 1963, early on a Sunday morning, I can remember getting ready for church with my family. We often listened in my household to radio programs as we had our breakfast together before heading out to Sunday school. On that particular morning, the programs were interrupted by a special bulletin concerning the death of four little girls: Addie Mae Collins, Cynthia Wesley, Carol Robertson, and Denise McNair. In an act of racial terrorism, a bomb was thrown into the 16th Street Baptist Church, killing the children who were robing and getting ready to sing in the children's choir for the morning service. I was old enough at that point to know that on a Sunday morning, that church was supposed to be not only a sacred space, but a safe space. Church buildings, a sanctuary for the faithful, were not generally the scene of bombing attacks or confrontational violence. And where there was violence, in my young mind at least, adults did not murder children. Of course, I was wrong. And of course, the death of the four little girls, although they did make the news, the perpetrator was not punished except for the fact that he paid a $100 fine for owning a box of dynamite. These children were not martyred for standing up for justice, but for following the way of hope. They died a violent death with no repercussions because the Klan set the context of justice, and the lives of four little Negro girls were valueless, and there were because they were far more trouble than hopeful. Early in August, in the summer of 1963, there was a march on Washington for jobs and freedom. Likely you've heard of this, because it was the stage for the famous I Have a Dream speech given by the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. It is an iconic speech. It is the most quoted of Dr. King's public addresses. It is remembered and quoted at every MLK Day every year, and it reminds us to keep the dream alive. In this short 50 years of working and marching, demonstrating and educating, integrating and articulating, I have to wonder if, much like our Saint John the Baptist, we have heard about the possibility and anticipated the hope for new ways, but some of us have missed the path, the way for both creating and sustaining beloved community. One half of a century, which is the better part of my life, has opened the entire world, the entire earth, to communication engagement. In a single day, we can see people from any country on the face of the earth in our own neighborhoods. And believe me, that's particularly true in Boston. We can hear a dozen languages, eat the cuisine of two dozen cultures, talk on a phone to anywhere a dial tone can be reached, travel around the globe in less than 24 hours, share in the art, literature, and even daily news of peoples and events worldwide, and still, we struggle with what it means to employ the concepts of liberty and justice for all. Next year, in 2014, we will mark yet another 50th anniversary. Somewhere in the night between June 21 and 22 of 1964, three civil rights workers, James Earl Cheney, Andrew Goodman, and Michael Schwerner, were shot at close range by violent racists in Philadelphia, Mississippi. Their bodies were hidden in an earthen dam and found 44 days later. The state government refused to investigate, so the federal government came in and brought charges, but they were not able to get convictions. I guess these deaths were really hard for me because I was a young teenager, but these young men were just older than me, 20, 21, and 24. They, who had made a commitment to work at change, to do the work of justice, to prepare the way, having made their decision, they were murdered. 50 years, half a century of confrontation and change and activism and demonstration, and the richest country on the face of the earth is not able to move to justice for all. In our text this morning, we find John the Baptist alone in the wilderness. I kind of imagine him looking weary and forlorn in a kind of voice yelling, "Repent! The kingdom of God is at hand." He was wandering around, approaching anybody who would listen or pay attention, wondering if people could grasp the import of his message. In my youth, at the end of a decade of cultural violence and confrontation, I heard the admonition again, and still, prepare ye the way. It is hard work, my friends. The business of making a way, being an agent of change, discovering in your heart and mind and body and spirit the call to making a difference, living an ethical life that calls for demanding justice. The work of justice making is not required, but for us, people of faith, it is expected. We are the ones and twos and dozens who prepare the way. Hard work? Yes. It's not just hope. There is work to be done. We must listen and work to make health care and healthy living a possibility for everyone, and especially our seniors and children. We must work demanding that our schools are fully staffed and equipped so that all children everywhere come to schools and leave schools on a level playing field with skills and knowledge to have opportunities for a full life of work and vocational identity. We must advocate for and include immigrants and people of nations around the world who come to the USA for a better chance. Immigrants made this country. For many of our ancestors, there were people who came from other places on the earth here for a better place to live. Too much? Too many politics? Get that woman out of the pulpit? Can't imagine revolution in the status quo? If it's too hard for you with your prosperous education to step up to making a difference in the big picture, how about doing the work of justice on your threshold, in your home or your neighborhood? What about making Thanksgiving an act of commitment, not just once a year, but working in a community garden or a soup kitchen or giving to a food pantry all year round? We have not yet rid the United States of America of hunger. If you cannot abide changing the politics of food, which would eliminate hunger, perhaps you can shop with the hungry in mind. I'm thinking that maybe the old welcome wagons weren't such a bad idea. Welcoming new people to our neighborhoods or the workplace or your children's school or the church or the apartment next door is a good way to extend and support community. Take someone to the polling place, and here I have to stop and just say, when I first moved to Connecticut, they used different language for voting. We had aldermen, they have councilmen. I had no idea what this was. And my neighbors sat me down and told me what the politics of the community are. Offer a ride to the grocery store, or tell someone where the library is. I know they're going away, but we want to keep them alive. Bring a new friend to church. Lots of us don't even know our neighbors' names. How about all of us, everybody, using our voices and our words to make a difference? In a meeting the other day at my school, one of my colleagues said that he was so pleased that our college is recruiting students who are coming to college in the first generation and that we are increasing our international student enrollment. But, he said, we need to recruit regular people. No one said a word. In the season of darkness, I challenge all of us to take time for reflection and quiet, to move past our fears of the known and confront the possibilities of change that allows all of us in the culture and in our world, to make a new kind of history. Would it not be wonderful 50 years from now to celebrate the end of hunger, healthy living, diverse and inclusive communities where people know each other's names and learn to pronounce them, where all schools work toward excellence, and where young people who made a commitment for justice are regaled and supported and mentored, not martyred? None of us, not one of us in this place, has to die to take on the work of preparing the way. Martyrdom is not required. You do not have to die to be an agent of change, to do the work of justice. Just make a commitment, all of us, to use our skills, energies, passions, time, effort, resources, body, brain, hands, and feet to be a spoke in the wheel of change. Hard work, yes. And 50 years from now, we will not be rehearsing the memory of violence and martyrdom, but rather generations of folks who leave behind a clear and open path for strong, supportive communities, excellence in education, and vocation and justice as the only way of life. Hear these words of blessing and hope. Keep them in your heart as we go from this place of worship today. From the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. 1963 is not an end, but a beginning. And those who hope that the Negro needed to blow off steam and will now be content will have a rude awakening if the nation returns to business as usual. There will be neither rest nor tranquility in America until the Negro is granted citizenship rights. The whirlwinds of revolt will continue to shake the foundations of our nation until the bright day of justice emerges. From Audre Lorde, we must transform our silence into action. It is vitally necessary for each one of us to establish and examine the way we function in the world to bring about transformation. And from Sweet Honey in the Rock, we who believe in freedom cannot rest until it comes. And finally, please pray with me these words of blessing from the Reverend Dr. James A. Forbes. God of love, power, and justice, who wills the freedom and fulfillment of all of your children, we thank you for the constancy of your loving kindness and tender mercies toward us. Because our needs are so great today and your care so constant, we know that you are rebuilding the network of compassion around new visionaries who you have assembled for this hour. Surprise us with the discovery of how much power we have to make a difference in our day, a difference in the way citizens meet, greet, respect, and protect the rights of each other, a difference in the breadth of our vision of what is possible in humanization, reconciliation, and equalization of results in our great cities. A difference in the way government, business, and labor can work together for justice and social enrichment. A difference in our response to the needy, and a difference in our appreciation for those who give of themselves for the surviving and thriving of our people. Help us to spark new hope and stir up our passion for new possibilities. May compassion and the spirit of sacrifice to be the new mark of affluence of our character. Strengthen us to face reality and to withstand the rigor of tough times and in anticipation of a bright side beyond the struggle. Inspire, empower, and sustain us until we reach the mountaintop and see the future for which our hearts yearn. This is our fervent prayer. We must prepare the way. Amen.